Hello, I'm Kathleen Fizakis. This is number 0482, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0482. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Phil Kogan, who is the new host of National Geographic's Explorer. How different is the travel schedule between this show and his other hit program, The Amazing Race?
We shoot 12 shows in 21 days on Amazing Race. We're flying through countries, literally hitting the ground sometimes for 24 hours. Whereas on Explorer, the whole idea is to dig in a little bit, get much more immersive, to go to a spot and then experience what that place has to offer, the people that are there, the passionate things that they're involved in. It's way more immersive, and we dig in deeper, I guess you could say.
Science writer Andrew Vizakis, the night sky guy, talks about a strange UFO that seems to have come from outside our galaxy.
It is a very odd shape. It's a kind of a cigar shape. It's 800 meters long, 80 meters wide. It's most likely composed of rock and ice, which would, if that's the case, I think astronomers would classify this as a comet.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. Among other things, he talks about a particular illegal alien in his city.
Well, this week we had a very pleasant surprise. In Central Park, they discovered a mandarin duck. I mean, a real mandarin duck. I know like that sounds like something you'd order on a Chinese restaurant menu, but there is such a thing as a mandarin duck. And the city's all excited about it. I'm worried about it because I'm afraid somebody's going to decide to eat it. And so far, it's being somewhat elusive. The Parks Department hasn't made any plans to catch it or do anything with it. So in the meantime, Mr. Duck or Mrs. Duck is perfectly safe.
And of course, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0482, was Kathleen Fizakis, the 9-year-old daughter of Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy. So this whole show seems to be a family affair. Thank you very much, Kathleen, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? There is no law here in Canada against actually being a witch, but pretending to be one is another matter, at least until a repeal proposed in June 2017 goes through. But law professor Stephen Coughlin suspects the proposal reminded the police that fraudulently pretending to exercise or use any kind of witchcraft is a crime. Last month, in two separate cases in Ontario, two women were charged with that crime. One is accused of convincing a man to rid himself of his home's evil spirits by selling it, and then getting rid of the money by putting it into her account. Her name is Samantha Stevenson. Okay, how many of you out there are old enough to remember the old TV series Bewitched? Notice any similarities in the name? 27-year-old Samantha Stevenson was arrested by Peel Regional Police. The old TV series starred a character by the name of Samantha Stevens. I wonder if the current Samantha Stevenson has a child named Tabitha. Just wondering. 70-year-old Palma Conrad called emergency services to report that she'd stabbed her husband. According to York, Pennsylvania police who interviewed her, Conrad was angry because her husband wanted to use medical marijuana, and while they argued, she got a knife and stabbed him in the chest, face, neck, and mouth. He was taken to the hospital in stable condition. Conrad reportedly expressed disappointment when she was told her husband would survive. Well, she faces charges of attempted murder, attempted homicide, and two counts of aggravated assault. You see, this is why some people think marijuana is a gateway drug to a life of crime. I mean, he didn't even get to try it. He was just thinking about it, and look what happened. Meanwhile, I think his wife might be a candidate for medical marijuana, so she can just simply chill out. Yeah. A rescue crew in DeLand, Florida, pulled a man out of a well in the pre-dawn hours of Halloween, but he hadn't fallen in. He wanted to go down the well just to say that he did it and get out of it, said Scott Smoke, battalion chief of Volusia County Fire Rescue Services. Unfortunately, he didn't have the strength to get out of it himself. Rescuers worked for over an hour to pull the unnamed man out of the 30-foot well, but he escaped with just a few cuts and bruises. I don't know. Maybe his real motivation was that he hoped to meet Lassie. Chief Smoke went on to say, "When you come across an open shaft of any kind that goes into a well, stay away from it. We need to get it marked and sealed up somehow and get a barrier around it so that we can prevent people from going down into these things." You know, warning kids not to jump into wells is one thing, but when you as a society have to go out of your way to protect adults from themselves, that's when we head down a slippery slope, much like a well. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, kids at Pierre Part Primary School in Pierre Part, Louisiana, thought they knew what to expect during Red Ribbon Week, an annual alcohol awareness program, but a school administrator threw them a curveball. 49-year-old Rachel Turley, assistant principal at the school, was on her way to work on October 29th, when other motorists reported that she was driving dangerously on Highway 70. Officers caught up with her at the school and took her to a police substation, where they determined her blood alcohol content was 0.224, nearly three times the legal limit of 0.08. She was charged with DWI and careless operation. The fact that she chose to do this on the Monday of Red Ribbon Week is a slap in the face, commented Nikki Lacoste, who is a grandparent of a Pierre Part student. Well, actually, what better example than to see your assistant principal hauled off to jail? Nothing like visual aids to drive the point home, don't you think? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? National Geographic's long-running, critically acclaimed documentary series Explorer returns with all new episodes on Monday, November the 12th, and at the helm as the show's host this year is a very familiar, well-traveled, Emmy Award-winning TV personality. That would be Phil Kogan. Phil joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles to talk a little bit about his new show. Hi, Phil.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Excited to share news about this new series.
Thanks for being on the program with us. As I mentioned to you just off air, I'm a big fan of your work on your other series, The Amazing Race. This is another opportunity for you to travel. And the one question I have that concerns both shows, I know with Amazing Race, it's a hurry up and race kind of thing. You don't get a time to sort of smell the roses. With this show, National Geographic's Explorer, do you get more time to absorb the locations and locales you're in?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great way of distinguishing the difference. You know, we shoot 12 shows in 21 days on Amazing Race. We're flying through countries, literally hitting the ground sometimes for 24 hours. Whereas on Explorer, the whole idea is to dig in a little bit, get much more immersive, to go to a spot and then experience what that place has to offer, the people that are there, the passionate things that they're involved in. And so, yeah, it's way more immersive, and we dig in deeper, I guess you could say.
You certainly did dig in deep in the first episode. I happened to see a screener of that one where you're into a volcano, and I'll get to that in a moment. How did you come to be part of this series, this long-running series? It seems like a perfect marriage. You'd think it was something that would happen sooner.
Well, about a year ago, just over a year ago, I was asked to host a show called Earth Live on Nat Geo with Jane Lynch, and we went 2 hours. We did a two-hour show around the world, 25 different countries, I think, and it was a big success to see wildlife around the world live in this spectacle, and I guess that sort of got the attention of some of the executives over at Nat Geo, who then were looking at revamping National Geographic Explorer. And Explorer, as you may know, is the longest-running documentary series on TV. It started way back in the mid-80s, and you know, as soon as I tell people that I'm involved with the series, the first thing they do is sort of hum the tune, da 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 da. And so, it's an iconic show that I first discovered when I came to America. So I've had a long-standing passion for this particular show, and so when they called me and said they were looking for a new host, and they were looking at me or considering me, I was incredibly excited. So I guess the planets aligned and the opportunity presented itself, and it's pretty extraordinary.
Besides being the host, is your input involved in the show? In other words, for the series now, are there stories or items that you particularly wanted to cover?
Yeah, so I am very immersive in everything that I make. So the scripting, the research, I like to dig in. I've never been, you know, from the beginning of when I started. I mean, it's the same on An Amazing Race, where I write the scripts there and I get heavily involved in the research and the locations we're going into. If I was just a talking head, if I was just someone who went out in front of the camera, I would have gone out of my mind a long, long time ago. It's what people see, of course, because that's where I am in front of the camera. But really, the part that I enjoy the most is digging into what are the stories we're going to tell, where are we going to go, who are we going to talk to. My job really as a hostess to be a facilitator, to communicate a story, to make the people that I'm talking to, wherever I am in the world, the stars, to make them shine. I see my role much more as somebody who is there to facilitate the story, to bring the story to life through the eyes of passionate people, more than it is to just be the face of a show.
Now, one of the most dangerous things you do on The Amazing Race probably is maybe being aggressively hugged when you're at the mat. This is a different situation with this show, again, based on just seeing the screener with you at a volcano in Nicaragua. All I kept thinking, just watching the scenes where you're standing on the edge, is what kind of insurance rider does National Geographic have out on you?
Well, you know, my whole career, I've been in front of a camera now for over 30 years, and my whole career I've taken a lot of calculated risks. So there's really nothing that I'm doing that isn't a calculated risk. Yes, I mean, there's definitely insurance considerations when you're dropping 60 stories into one of the most active volcanoes in the world, surrounded by sulfur dioxide and which completely destroyed our equipment. Yes, there's a certain amount of risk. But if you look back on my career and you look at, world record bungee jumping attempts and diving the world's longest underwater caves, my career's been full of live skydiving and that sort of thing. My career's been full of calculated risks. Not something you see me do necessarily on Amazing Race, but certainly a big part of my career.
Now, getting back to that volcano for a second, how hot was it going down there?
It was not so much hot. Just we were just surrounded by these gases, which burnt your eyes, and which, you know, this is the reason I had to wear a gas mask. Certainly near the edge got extremely hot. When we got towards the edge and we looked down into the liquid lava, it's one of the few places in the world where you see boiling lava where you can look at it directly. Absolutely. I mean, it's scorching. I mean, it's the kind of heat that you can't describe. It's the kind of heat that can vaporize things. But where we were walking around the crater on the base level with looking down into the little lava lake, and obviously every time we got to the edge, that heat would hit us. But the temperatures would fluctuate tremendously depending on where we stood.
When I watched that episode and you were down at the furthest depths, all I kept thinking is before you went down, I could see on your hand you had a wedding ring, and I thought, doesn't gold conduct heat? How hot is that going to get down there?
You're an extremely observant young man. You're absolutely right. And as a matter of fact, there was a point where I did feel some heat on my hand. Yes, very observant of you. I was wearing gloves a lot of the time because there is volcanic glass, and what happens is you end up with these almost like they're almost like imagine a glass needle and a lot of glass needles that sort of pile up on top of each other. So they almost it almost becomes like a cushion of glass, if that makes any sense. And if you put your hand on anything down there, you get these pieces of glass in your hand. So I ended up with pieces of glass in my hand for weeks after. I was still picking up bits of this little of this black glass. So for a lot of time, I was trying to wear a glove to protect myself. But I was also operating a camera at times, and so it was very difficult to operate a camera with gloves on. So I kept pulling the gloves off, and inadvertently ended up with glass in my hand. But you know, this particular volcano that we go into, it's called the Messiah Volcano. It's the mouth of hell, as the locals have referred to it for many years. There's a million people not too far away from this volcano. It's very active. Active all the time. And so we were there with the volcanologists who were monitoring this volcano, constantly monitoring this volcano to try to give early warning signs to people living nearby that they need to get out of harm's way. And that was really what this story is all about. And, you know, the whole point of Explora is to really open up people's eyes to the world and the people who and how people are interacting with the world. And quite frankly, there's never been a better time for us to be doing this series, because we all really do need to wake up as to what's going on and take comfort in the fact that there are some very passionate individuals out in the world trying to help protect what we have, the resources that we have. But this to me, Explora right now is more pertinent than it's ever been.
Do you get the feeling in doing this type of show and traveling around the world, because you talk about the importance of this planet and our existence on it. The one thing I've always maintained is that people talk about saving the planet. The planet will be just fine. It's whether it wants us on it or not.
I think you've made a very, very astute observation there. You know, my dad is a plant scientist. And he said exactly the same thing to me recently. I was at home visiting him in New Zealand, and he said exactly the same. He said, well, don't worry about the planet. The planet's going to be totally fine. It'll be here well after we're here. No matter what we do, we can't destroy the planet. We talk about destroying the planet. He said, we're never going to destroy the planet. Everything we're doing on the surface will fold back into itself, into the Earth, and it will melt back down, and the planet will end up producing life just as it has done for millions of years. No, it's much less about what damage we're doing to the planet and more about what we're doing to ourselves. Will we have air to breathe? Will we have trees to make oxygen? Will we have food sources? Will we have places to build homes? So it's much more about whether we can sustain our life on this planet than it is about whether the planet's going to be okay.
With the shows that you do, this show, Explorer, on National Geographic, and also The Amazing Race, you get to travel a lot. Where does Phil Kogan like to be when he's not traveling for work?
Well, I like to travel.
Well, that's why I said for work. I mean, I assume you like to travel someplace, but
yeah.
On your own time, where do you like to be?
I like to visit new places. So, I don't feel like I work. And I don't really feel like there's a separation between what I want to do in my personal life and what I do for a living. I can't quite believe that I get paid to go. For instance, I was just recently on Explorer diving with whale sharks off the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula and staring into the mouth of a whale shark. 5 feet across, this whale shark's pumping gallons of water, tens of gallons of water through its gills to filter out the krill, this mysterious creature, which is in fact a shark, the world's biggest fish. You're surrounded by 200-300 of these huge creatures that are the size of a school bus, 30-40 feet long. And quite frankly, that's what I would be doing if I wasn't working. I just get paid to do these things and have to pinch myself sometimes. So I have a place in New Zealand where I'm originally from. I love going home because I just love being around people I want to be with, which includes my family. Thankfully, I like my family. I mentioned my dad's a plant scientist. We get on really well, and my mom is a music teacher, and I feel very lucky that I still have them in my life. And so I love to get home, but yeah, no, I really do think about where I'm going to go and what I'm going to do. So there's no sort of distinction between, oh, this is work and this is personal time. It's all sort of, I would pay to do the things that I get paid to do, if that makes sense.
It does, absolutely. And we're so thankful that when you do get to travel for work, you get to take us along with you. Phil, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you. And I just want to mention that I'm working with a cast of world-class storytellers who are part of the team. And what I love about it is we have tremendous diversity in these correspondents who have a different lens to be able to share the world. And I think that's what will separate this show from other news-type shows or magazine-type shows is the filter, the lens that they look at the world and share these stories through.
Yes, it is a very diverse crew, and you get to see many stories in the course of one show, which makes it very appealing for all people.
Exactly, and that's what it's got to be, because the sooner we figure out that we're all sharing this planet as human beings and not as these divided groups, the sooner or the better chance we have of actually surviving. Because, as you said, to your point, the planet's going to be fine. The question is, will we?
Thank you, Phil, for being on the show with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Phil Kogan, host of Explorer on National Geographic. The new season premieres on Monday, November the 12th. It's a fascinating experience. Check your local listings. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is your safe haven from the hard news of the day. The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for your happy place.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, plus Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, is on the program as well. Here on a show that is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, are you getting tired of all these emotional support animal stories that have been taking the world by storm lately? Well, here's the latest one to make you lose your lunch. These emotional support animals are getting really comfortable on flights. Delta Airlines issued an apology after a Michigan man said he boarded a flight in Atlanta and sat in dog poop. Matthew Meehan said he boarded a flight from Atlanta to Miami, and he was already sitting down when he discovered there was dog feces all over the chair and floor. Actual feces, and it was all over me. I sat in it, and it was on the seat, on the floor, the seat in front, and I was literally in it, Meehan said. Meehan said he and the passenger sitting next to him were offered very little help with the situation. I have no idea why I wasn't offered something from a biohazard kit to clean myself up with. Instead, I was handed two paper towels and one of those miniature bottles of Bombay Sapphire, a bottle of gin to clean myself up with, Meehan said. Well, that's just a waste of good gin. Delta addressed the incident in a statement. The safety and health of our customers and employees is our top priority, and we are conducting a full investigation while following up with the right teams to prevent this from happening again. Upon landing in Miami, the aircraft was taken out of service to be deep cleaned and disinfected, the statement said. You know, somewhere out there is a callous pig of a human being who knows their dog did this. A callous pig who calmly walked off of the flight with their dog and said nothing. Hopefully, the airline will be tracking down the seat manifest to see who was sitting there. Also, hopefully, the airline will do the right thing and bend over backwards to whatever demands Matthew Meehan might have. And speaking of pigs, two female students at Fletcher High School in Jacksonville, Florida, apparently confided in each other. One said she was having sex with teacher 30-year-old Corey French and that he was in love with her. The other was incensed. She was having sex with him too, and he promised to run away with her. Rather than call police, the girls joined forces and told French's wife, proving their allegations with photos of the sexcapades. The students are refusing to press charges, but French has been arrested anyway, charged with two counts of felony unlawful sexual activity with a minor. When the school started procedures to fire him, French resigned. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, or in this case, three. He now has three women who are thoroughly angered by this callous pig. What are the odds that more students might come out of the woodwork on this one? Let's just wait and see. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a peanut butter lover found with horrific injuries may have played a role in the life-changing injury to his junk. Last month, in an apartment in Haddington, Scotland, the fully clothed 22-year-old was found unconscious and lying in a pool of blood. His lower body injuries were extreme enough to be considered life-threatening. He was rushed to Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, where doctors discovered his penis and testicles had been gnawed off by a dog. The culprit was a hungry bulldog named Biggie Smalls. The pooch is believed to have eaten the man's genitals so they could not be reattached. Police originally believed the man, who had been put into an induced coma and couldn't explain how he had been hurt, was attacked by the dog in his flat while a friend held him down. But the victim, who has since regained consciousness, later fessed up that he smeared peanut butter or another food spread on his goodies before he was savaged by the dog while they were alone in the apartment. Biggie is such a nice dog, a neighbor said. He isn't aggressive or anything, and he's quite small. He's fine with other dogs. The dog is an absolute angel. I was happy to be around him. He gets a little freaked out by noise, but he loves having his belly rubbed. Yeah, well, you know, over the years, we've had various stories where someone smears peanut butter over their privates so that a dog can lick it off. But this is the first story that shows just how dumb this idea is and how it can go horribly wrong. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A space object got lots of overheated attention this past week after a widely respected Harvard scientist co-authored a paper suggesting the interstellar visitor could have been an alien spacecraft powered by solar radiation pressure. To talk about this realistically and perhaps put the brakes on such speculation, we are joined once again by science writer Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of Star Trek, The Official Guide to Our Universe, The True Science Behind the Starship Voyages. He joins us via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
I'm just trying to figure out why someone who is as well revered as this particular scientist is would put out a new paper speculating the idea that aliens sent whatever that is floating through space into our space.
Well, exactly. And, you know, it's the fact that it's the authors on this study being such well-known astrophysicists. One of them is a leader in research in black holes and such. And so this really catches the attention of not just the scientific community, but the general public as well. Is like, why is such a scientist involved? And this fellow is actually one of the co-authors is a expert not only on black holes and all kinds of natural phenomenon, but is also an expert in solar sail technology and is directly involved in an initiative called Breakthrough Slingshot, which is a Starshot, I should say, Breakthrough Starshot, which is an effort, a consortium of scientists and investors looking to use new age propulsion to travel to other stars. And he's been heavily involved in that for a while now. And so I think this whole mystery surrounding this alien or interstellar object that came through the solar system late last year caught his attention too, and said, well, he looked at the data and it was interesting because much of, you know, of what we understand of natural objects, all the physical data that we've accumulated over many years through space missions and large telescopes, has that data hasn't been able to been matched with what we received, the observations of these objects. And so he did take a look, and he noticed that he could actually explain a lot of what the physical features and behaviors of this object as it moved through space matched what we would have seen if of a solar sail probe at that same distance. So it kind of was interesting to put this down on paper, and it just made a huge buzz.
So far, what we do know, this thing, which is cigar-shaped, is and has been named Oumuamua, which is Hawaiian for scout or messenger, has been floating through our galaxy and suddenly took off at warp speed, for lack of a better term. What do you think it is?
Well, it is a very odd shape. It's a kind of a cigar shape. It's 800 meters long, 80 meters wide. It's most likely composed of rock and ice, which would, if that's the case, I think astronomers would classify this as a comet. And just a refresher for everyone out there, a comet is basically, you can think of it as a dirty snowball, a giant one the size of a mountain, a mixture of a lot of rock and ice all mushed together, in this case in a very bizarre shape perhaps. And when comets are usually just in a real rock-hard frozen state in outer space, but every once in a while they get drawn in by the gravity of the sun, and when they get close to the sun or other stars, they start melting. And when that happens, there's a lot of trapped gas pockets deep within this rock-hard ice ball that gets released. And these gases and dust that gets shed from the comet head produces that famous romantic tail that we always see stretched out behind the head of a comet. Very romantic, image of one.
Isn't part of the problem the fact that this particular, whatever it is, doesn't have said tail?
Well, exactly. What they were looking for are what we call outgassing from the comet. And we did not see that. None of it. There's no idea. When this object was closer to the sun last year, and we could actually image it with the Hubble Space Telescope, we noticed that there was none of these gases escaping, nothing flying off this object. And that's very strange. Also, the trajectory of this object clearly indicates it comes from beyond the solar system, what we call interstellar space. And it's actually accelerating now as it's leaving the solar system. It's currently between the orbits of Jupiter and Neptune and moving at 300,000 kilometers an hour. And the behavior of it as it's moving, you can't explain it by simple gravitational forces. And this is what's left the scientific community scratching their heads. It's nothing like it that we've seen in nature.
Well, compare the speed that it's going at, you say about 300,000 miles per hour. Compare that to other things that we have known to, we are aware of that fly through the galaxy, be it comets or whatever. How much faster or slower is this compared to other things we've seen and charted before?
I mean, this thing is really moving quickly, and I would say it's on the top end of what we would see other comets moving in space. So it is something noteworthy, the speed. It's also that the trajectory of it is different. So exactly how the movement is, it's in fact one of the authors, again, with his theory of the solar sail probe, the movement of this visitor is really what we might expect if the object was designed to be propelled through space using the force of the sun's light or a starlight, as in the case of a light sail. So, you know, if you want to really think fantastical things, you would say perhaps it's some kind of solar sail in interstellar space, been floating around as debris, maybe from an advanced technological civilization. But again, you know, I like to always go back to what the late Carl Sagan, astronomer, used to say: extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And unfortunately, we just don't have enough data. We can't see this thing anymore, Peter, because it's just too faint and too far away. So this particular object will always remain forever a mystery now, to us, because we cannot see it anymore.
We don't really know where it came from, but you earlier mentioned where it is right now. Do we have any idea where it's going?
You know, looking at, you know, because we can't watch it anymore, we can't plot its path and then, you know, extrapolate. But from everything that we accumulated in those precious 3 months from October to January with the Hubble Space Telescope, we can sort of chart it that it will be going to other star systems within the next 10 light years distance from us. And the fact is, it could have come from hundreds of light years away in other planetary systems. My guess is this is a fragment. This is a natural object, not an artificially made one, most likely. And it's probably a fragment of some kind of either explosion or collision of objects like a comet smashing into a planet or asteroid. And this is a fragment of that collision that's just been sent careening out into interstellar space. And we just happen to be in the way.
On its journey through our galaxy, how close did it get to us?
Well, it was well over 100 million kilometers away from us. It didn't. There was no chance of collision with us. Nothing that not close enough for, let's say, backyard telescopes even to notice it. So it really took the largest optical telescopes we had to really spy it. But it's amazing. It shows that our technology can pick stuff like this up. And in fact, now this is on the radar of all astronomers. That, you know, even if we don't know the true nature of this object, the fact that we can definitely say that it came from beyond the solar system, this is the first recording of such an encounter, that we are going to be looking for other interstellar visitors in the future so that we can get more data on this. If we saw one, then there's a very good likelihood that we'll see others.
And going on the theory that you mentioned earlier, that it was fragments of something that was blasted, either two things collided or a distant planet was hit, just like anything else that breaks off or chips off something that flies through the air, it's not just one fragment. So there could be more fragments of this same piece of whatever it is that could be following it down the road, so to speak.
Exactly. Where there's one fragment, if this is truly from an explosion or a collision, there'll be other fragments propelled away from that site, and we could very well expect other fragments that might become visible to our telescopes as well. So I think scientists are very much on the alert. This particular latest paper coming out, you know, theorizing an artificial, you know, source to it, an alien source to it, is very interesting. We can't rule that out, I have to say. It's possible, but not probable. But I guess, you know, it's interesting. We live in the times where we've cataloged thousands of planets beyond our solar system. We know dozens that could be habitable. It's not out of the realm of reality to say that, you know, we are not alone. But I guess I have to leave it at the point of saying the truth is out there.
Andrew, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being on the show once again.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy and author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0482, and you'll find links to Andrew's site. You'll also find links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Frank Kelly served as a state attorney general longer than anyone in the history of the United States. During a 37-year career in Michigan, the lifelong Democrat created the country's first consumer protection division. Frank Kelly's reputation as a consumer advocate helped him win 10 elections, as well as the support of many trial lawyers. So, when Kelly retired and he was asked to speak to a large group of lawyers, he surprised many when he told them that there's too much litigation today. He said, "Too many lawyers think that lawsuits are the first resort, when they should be the last resort." His comments were reported in the newspaper the next day, and I've kept that article ever since. Let's be fair. Last week we heard that the former liberal icon George McGovern believed there are too many lawsuits in America, and this week we hear the same thing from the Attorney General who created the very first government agency to protect consumers. It reveals that support for ending the problem of excessive litigation is much more widespread than many may think. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, Peter Franklin is indeed with us from the Big Apple, New York City. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello. Live from the greatest city on the face of the earth. It's a pretty nice place to come visit. So I invite everybody, come visit.
Well, everyone is visiting New York these days. Apparently, there's a Mandarin duck in Central Park.
Yeah, let me explain. Let me explain to you people. You people think of us just as a concrete jungle. No. We have more parks and greenery and flora and fauna than any other major city in the United States, wall to wall. We have deer, we have raccoons, we have skunks, you name it, they come into the city. Well, this week we had a very pleasant surprise. In Central Park, they discovered a Mandarin duck. I mean, a real Mandarin duck. I know like that sounds like something you'd order on a Chinese restaurant menu, but there is such a thing as a Mandarin duck. And there's a picture of it on my website, which is gabby.com. I didn't take the picture, but I got the picture. And the city's all excited about it. I'm worried about it because I'm afraid somebody's going to decide to eat it. And so far, it's being somewhat elusive. The Parks Department hasn't made any plans to catch it or do anything with it. So in the meantime, Mr. Duck or Mrs. Duck is perfectly safe. the question has to be answered, how did she get here? And as long as she got here, or he, I hope it's safe, you know? It's like if we had an alligator in Central Park, you wouldn't want it to end up as a purse.
Yes. Well, I know one way it didn't get there, and that's by subway, because if it had traveled on the subway, it probably would have been eaten. What's the story about people who are having full course meals on the train?
Yeah, well, originally, and in the years gone by, this was not really just a problem of eating a sandwich, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or maybe a Frank or something, you know, something less complicated. But as time has gone on, people have started sitting and having a whole meal, you know, in like one of those compartment plates or something, with chicken and bones and potatoes and everything. And it's making a mess out of the subway. So the first step, stage one, is that the city is about to stop, or the subway system is about to stop the food places that are in the subway system. They're not going to let them make things like southern fried chicken and all that kind of stuff. And then I suspect the second step will be not to let people continue to do the eating. However, that's where we're going to run into a problem, enforcement. How do you stop New Yorkers from eating? I warn all my tourist friends, all my visiting friends, your biggest danger in coming to New York is you're going to get fat.
Are you allowed to have a full course meal in the backseat of your taxi?
Yeah, I do. I know. When people raise that question, I said yes, but they have to promise there's not going to be a food fight. No, no. If I'm giving somebody a tour, and that can take a whole day, 7 hours, obviously there's a point at which you want to eat. And you have the option of either stopping and going into a delicious delicatessen, or if you prefer, pick a sandwich up from the delicatessen and eat it as we go. People are very good about that. It seems when they get into other people's cars, they kind of... Didn't eat. That's not been a problem at all.
But I guess the one thing you have to worry about if you're eating in the backseat of your taxi is what happens if you've got that food on your lap and you hit a pothole.
Well, now you're talking what's very common to New York City. It's one thing to have a little hole, but it's another thing to have a big hole. And what New York City does, it's not a question of money, by the way. We have enough money to fix everything. We got enough equipment to fix everything, enough personnel. It's just that we have so many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of streets that they're always in somewhat disrepair. I always say to people, this week looks bad, next week it's going to be fine, and another one's going to look terrible. Anyway, but the rules go in New York City that if you hit a pothole and there's any damage to your car, as long as you can document it, and it turns out that the pothole wasn't being fixed that day, it was just sitting there, there's a very good chance you're going to collect money for the damages to the car. And I don't think people are riding around trying to intentionally hit potholes, because who wants to have their car damaged just to get a few bucks out of the city? But by and large, it is a little extra to your vacation. If you hit a pothole, break an axle or something, you get some money. I know it sounds crazy, but that's what this place is. It's crazy.
Meanwhile, and you know, we keep hearing all these stories about the supposed fake news. Now I understand there's a fake newsstand in New York City?
Yeah, well, what they did is in Bryant Park, which is right in the middle of New York, in Manhattan, right next to the New York Public Library, the one that has the two lions and is so famous, they put a newsstand, and the newsstand carries only fake news. Different kinds of publications. I mean, at least they're sitting in judgment as to what's fake and what's not fake. So the newsstand isn't fake, but most of the publications that have all the news stories in them are just fake. But that's one thing you got to admit with Trump. I mean, and I don't particularly want to go out of my way to bash journalists all over, but the news is kind of slanted. It really is to your political opinion. And I don't think that's right if you're just being a reporter. Columnist, that's something different. A reporter, play it straight.
And there was a celebrity in the news. I know you don't have celebrity sightings these days because, you know, you always see celebrities all the time, Peter. I know that. But I'm glad that you weren't the one who personally cited Alec Baldwin because... Boy, if he and you and he got into an argument over a parking spot, I don't know how that would end.
No, it wouldn't end in any way. First of all, I met Alec Baldwin once at the U.S. Open. It must have been about 2 or 3 years ago. And he was a delightful, pleasant, very nice fellow who was talking to everybody around and being almost charming. And he made the point at that time, not that there had been an incident, but the thing that bugs him the most is that when he's with his family, his wife or his children, you'll have a whole bunch of paparazzi come running over to start taking pictures and this, that, and the other thing. And he says he'll initially say, please leave me alone. And then afterwards, when they don't, that's when he kind of erupts. I guess he needs some anger management by Jack Nicholson. But the fact of the matter is, in this particular situation, that's a pretty common occurrence. People think they can hold on to a parking spot. They do a lot of that in Little Italy with the wannabes. I'm talking about the mafia wannabes. We'll put a chair in a spot, and you come driving along. You'd like to park in the spot, but they're holding it for somebody else, which is impolite, rude, and thoroughly illegal. But people do it. What you do in a situation like that, at least what I do, is I pass it by. I'm not about to get into a confrontation with somebody who thinks they own the parking space, even though I know they don't own it. And that's what happened here. He was a dope. He really was. He thought he owned the spot, and he got into a confrontation with the guy. But it's now turned out that, first of all, the guy says that he didn't know who Alex Baldwin was. I think that's a big lie. He's one of the most famous people in American society. And number two, when the reporters went to visit him at his suburban house, they could see no signs of any damage to his face, you know, like a tooth knocked out or a scar or a bruise or a stitch. So I think it's the kind of deal to, you know, kind of make some money on this if he can.
Mm. Well, at the end of last month, at the end of October, of course, it was Halloween, and I understand that candy corn was the winner again this year for the favorite treat. I've never understood that, by the way. I hate candy corn, but anyway.
Yeah, but go, if I said to you right now, go outside and buy some, chances are you wouldn't be able to get it because it's sort of like a candy. It's the number one candy, but it's only sold really at Halloween. The only other thing I can think that's similar to that is something called Malamars. I don't know if you have Malamars or if you've ever had a Malamar. It's sort of a chocolate-covered marshmallow, and it's very popular. But it's only sold like in November, December, and January. That's probably because of the chocolate on it, which melts in your hands or something like that. So candy corn won the contest again for the most pieces, millions and millions of pounds of it. But right now, you're not going to find it on the streets of New York at all.
So now that Halloween is behind us already, everyone's getting ready apparently for Christmas, even though you guys in the United States haven't had Thanksgiving yet.
At least we had the protocol once upon a time that you would wait for Thanksgiving to be over. And now they've moved it back to October, where Halloween is just barely over. I think it's in very poor taste. I think there's something about it that's very discouraging. But all of the stores, or at least most of the stores, are starting to put up Christmas decorations. And I always like to say, money can't buy you happiness, but it sure can buy you an awful lot of decorations. And since we have some of the richest, most famous stores in the world, they got lots of money. But I think they should have at least waited until the morning after Thanksgiving, which was like the way they did in the good old days.
Well, the holiday season is the time of the year to really see New York, as it really does light up and it becomes a festive place. Not that it's not festive the rest of the year. And it might be a good time, if anybody's going to New York, to look you up, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. You can go to your website at gabby.com and perhaps get a tour of New York City during the holiday season. I'm sure that would be spectacular, sir.
Well, it is. It's a gorgeous city, and if it sounds like I love it, I certainly do.
Peter, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Take care. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have one more item to share with you. Yes, it's the moment you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A husband who faked his wife's suicide is facing life in jail after he boasted to a blonde in a pub by saying, "I strangled her." 64-year-old Derek Potter tried to cover up the killing by pretending his wife, Leslie, hanged herself at their home. Police did not at first treat Mrs. Potter's death as suspicious, and her body was released to a funeral director. But roofer Potter confessed to the killing to a woman in his local pub just 1 week before the late Mrs. Potter was due to be cremated. He told a fellow builder named Natalia what he had done before asking her to move in with him. Natalia said, We were still on our first pints when he said, "I have got to tell you something." He said, "I love my wife very much, but she was doing my head in, so I strangled her." Natalia said she was left shocked and thought he was joking. She added, "He was saying it with a straight face, no tears in his eyes, no laughter. I thought, oh my God, he's done it." The death was reinvestigated after she tipped off police. Potter of Mumbles near Swansea denied the murder, but a jury took just 1 hour and 11 minutes to find him guilty. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you tell a woman at a pub that you killed your wife just a week before your deceased mate is due to be cremated and you would have gotten away with it? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0482. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0482. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.